Support for this public radio podcast comes from the dairy families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont. On the web at go.coop.
You fry some garlic. And you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got to do it boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? A little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry. Stay hungry. Stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Jordan. How you doing this evening? If you're listening in real time, hope you're warm, dry, happy. This is a good thing, reason to celebrate. It may not be a drought year after all. I was very worried, but I think we're closing in on... We're over 50%, I know that. We could be over 60% of what we need for this season, so raise a glass to the rain. Tonight we have just one guest after having full houses for a while. We have Aaron, I'm going to say it right, Lucich?
Yeah, you did.
Cool, I did. Actually, we heard about you from last week's guest, Frederic Lavoie-Pierre, who for 4 years was Mouthful's engineer as well.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
good.
So now you have come prepared. There is a feast before us. Let's see. You've got Drunken Goat, Humboldt Fog, Prosciutto, another one over there, Manchego. Should have brought some quince paste, nice rustic sausage, and some Pinot Noir. So
Fromani, actually.
This is just the way I like to do Mouthful. So welcome.
Thank you.
And you were at a conference, right?
Eco Farm,
right.
Down in Asilomar.
Asilomar. And want to tell it? Let's talk about you just jumped into this world of food, because you're relatively new to it.
Yeah. I'm just a couple years into this, yeah. Mm-hmm. I was working in the Bay Area broadcast scene.
So oh, really?
I'm used to being in the control room,
producing,
and then I found out I was going to be a father, and I woke up every night in the middle of the night wondering what my daughter was going to think of what I did with my life, and so I thought I'm going to have to change who I work for and what I do with my days. And agriculture is what I thought I'd focus on.
Mm-hmm. So what were you doing in broadcasting?
I was working as a producer at a facility in San Francisco called ITN. We housed Fox Sports, Fox News, worked for all the broadcast cable news networks. Mm-hmm. We also did the master control for WorldLink TV. Link TV, yeah. So a lot of, and it was in the internet boom when everybody was, you know, raising lots of money,
yeah,
doing very good things with it.
Mm-hmm.
So communications, lots of internet streaming, the beginning of that whole world, lots of financial stuff, and lots of conservative broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
And
Fox News, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd call that conservative.
And stuff, I mean, I did a lot of media tours things, so mm-hmm. so fake news that mm-hmm. was designed to get people to spend money, you know? It's kind of the rules.
Yeah, that's sort of what mainstream broadcasting is about, separate people from their cash.
Yeah, yeah, and it's all, you know, the whole thing is that big party. So, so I kind of hit this place where I thought I wasn't in that career too long. I kind of came into it in my mid-30s. And so I wasn't attached to any dogmatic belief in what I was supposed to do. So I thought, how do I take the skill set that I'd recently acquired and use it to, I think, help the health and habitat of my children? And I have another child now. Alexander's 3, and Zoe is going to be 6. Yeah. So, yeah, that was about 3 years ago I made the decision to do that, and 2 years ago I started rolling on this project, or to September.
So have you left the broadcasting world, ITN?
Not completely. Not completely. I started saying no to certain things, like no if the end client was selling pharmaceuticals to the public, which I kind of disagree with, but I'd done that in the past. You know, this is, I come clean here. So anything that I kind of felt trickled up to something inherently bad, or not necessarily looking out for, you know, for the betterment of us, I started saying no to. So, you know, the big, a lot. That's a lot of companies.
Absolutely.
World. And a lot of broadcast entities. So I just did something, though. I'm kind of running out of cash, looking for investors. And so I'm starting to take on some work. But, yeah, it's a real tiptoe kind of dance to do to try to be socially conscious about the clients that you work for.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, as a freelancer, I mean, I don't make my living in radio.
Yeah.
You know, this is just my... This is how I spend my free time, some of my free time, but I make my living as a writer.
Yeah.
And you really, I think, not everyone does this, but you have to have that inner moral compass so that you don't end up feeling like a whore, really.
Well, yeah, but we all are, you know, kind of at the end of the day. And it's this real easy thing. Everybody in the world would say, you know, do what you need to do, provide for your kids, and then use that to do something really good. And I just, you know, the Eichmann defense just stopped making sense to me. And I thought also, you know, this thing, I'm PR, right? So I come up with slogans for everything. And I started coming up, this thing kept coming up called the obligation of opportunity. And I thought, you know, I'm a white man in America. If I can't risk and change things, then who's going to? And I just, you know, so I just went, well, I have to cold turkey and go for it.
And what did that mean? How did you go for it?
Well, I started shooting.
You started shooting a film.
Started shooting a film.
Okay. It's like, oh no, he took out a gun.
No, I started shooting a film, which we didn't even talk about yet, called We Are What We Eat, Part 1.
So you decided that the way for you to venture into agriculture and that whole realm was to put something about it onto film.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the clients that I had no conflict with is a company called Netflix.
I know Netflix.
And I went out on my own with them as they were kind of taking off.
Oh.
And so they were a good client for a period of time, and that got me to every film festival, all the major film festivals in the world, for about 4 years running. And that's when I saw documentary content really elevating into theatrical entertainment. And so when I kind of hit this impasse for myself, like I can't... in that period, I thought, okay, I need more clients. So I took a job for MSNBC producing on the Michael Savage show. I don't know if you know who he is. He's a big radio personality.
Yeah, I know the name.
Yeah, so
I get him mixed up with Dan Savage, which is another thing entirely.
I would love to produce the Dan Savage radio show.
Yeah,
but no, it was Michael Savage, and that had a bad ending. It had a bad ending for me, and then he had a bad ending shortly after that. So, I realized I couldn't really work in the broadcast world at that point because it's just too tied to, you know, corporate agendas.
Sounds like you need to be in public radio.
No, I also need to be in the... I also have this problem with the nonprofit world. That's so okay. I'm in this really...
Yeah, and you need to make money.
Yeah. So anyway, I kind of went through all those things and I watched how documentary content was really finding its legs. It was a different thing. I met the guys who did The Corporation at Sundance, and I was really just inspired. Also, was around Michael Moore. We were doing work with Variety at Cannes when Michael Moore was there shopping for distribution. And so I just thought, God, I could make a documentary film, and and I could make it about something that I thought had a significant impact on who we are, how we live, and agriculture was the topic. Yeah.
So you have about 15 minutes posted on your website.
Yeah, I made a short a year ago after running around the world a little bit, running around the country, one big lap of the country. And I had to figure out, one thing I needed to do was try to do some fundraising. Because I was self-funding, still am, but I had to figure out, is this working? Because I don't have enough lifetimes to read enough to appropriately approach this topic. So it's been a bit of an odyssey. It's been a start with one person and let that lead to another and lead to another. And this incredible community opened up and is really welcomed me in, and I've made an incredible amount of friends in that process. But it was a really iterative process for me to learn about what it is I was thinking I wanted to talk about. So a year ago, right around January last year, February, I cut this 15 minutes to be part of a fundraising package. And the goal was to just see, is it working? Is it making sense? Can I cut all of these experts together?
Now, what I saw were white guys talking.
Yeah.
That was the whole first part of it.
Yeah.
And I got the sense there you might be adding other things, people actually doing things with the land. Is that your intention?
Well, it's called We Are What We Eat, Part One. And the goal is to try to illuminate for the common man, the people who I live in Marin County. I drive out to Marin Sun Farms. I buy my meat.
You got
out there.
One of the best farmers markets anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I was at dinner at the Full Moon Feast last night, sitting across from Dan and Liz from Clark Summit Farms, sitting next to my friend Joel Salatin, and I could stay here in Northern California and have a great time. And my feeling about that is that it's about access. A lot of people don't have that access that we have. And so I'm focusing on what it's like when you live in Salina, Kansas, and you don't, and there's a lot of food grown around you, but it's not what you'd want to eat. It's not anything.
It's not a family farm. It's a big commodity farm.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, ironically, you know, that we've got an incredible local food movement and we've got pockets all over the world, but it's not moving fast enough. And if we don't change the lowest common denominator food and provide just healthy food and fiber, actual nutrition to those who have the least amount of access, then I think we're failing as a civilization.
I think I want to stop right there because that's a really good point, and I want that to resonate for a little bit. Take a musical break and talk in more detail about just that little piece.
Grapes are covering the grassland. They're buying up for family farms. Selling out. Who can blame them? Wine's a cash crop growing strong. And in the fields of Pembroke Valley, buildings sprout up like new sown seeds. Now they call it Telecom Central, 'cause this is what consumers need. I am the hand that rocks the cradle. I am the voice that sings their song. I am the one called local color, salt of the earth, but not for long. Take a look, 'cause I'm gone.
It is Mouthful, Public Radio for Sonoma County on KRCB. Aaron Lucich is my guest. He's making a film, We Are What We Eat. Now, I thought what you said before we took that musical break, that was, by the way, Local Color by Solid Air, is really key to a whole lot of what's going on. And it's been one of my, I don't know if complaint has the wrong nuance, really, but it seems that so much of the food movement, you know, that's been going on now since the 70s and with the current focus on slow food and all that, so much of it scratch the surface and you really get privilege right underneath the surface. And if you get good projects where people are, you know, doing things for school gardens and a whole variety of things and inner cities, that is still an offering from the vantage point of privilege. And as such, it can never be empowering. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I agree.
People who shop at Pep Boys, you know, people who live very, very or don't even have transportation to get to a farmer's market, those people need to have options and the sensibility to take the healthy options rather than being fed, you know, corporate fat.
Yeah, if it were only corporate fat, right? Yeah, it's we eat in America. We eat marketing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we eat biomass, but primarily it's marketing, and you know, and I didn't know a ton about how food was grown. I knew a little bit, but after spending 2 years, you know, running around and meeting the leadership of the sustainable agricultural movement, which are primarily white males. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I keep getting hammered for that. I got an email from England, and she said, it's a lot of white males. I said, yeah, there are.
Well, in that
are.
15-minute piece, but you could mitigate that really easily.
Well, you can mitigate it, but still, you know, like I just talked to Mary... See, I was driving up here hoping that I wouldn't that I'd have an on night where
it's
I actually
okay.
had my memory.
it's okay. You were talking to, talking to a colleague.
Klaus and Mary Howell Martins are big leaders in the ag community, and she's on the board of I guess the Sustainable Ag Program at Cornell. But they're big acres people.
Mm-hmm.
She's one. Elaine Ingham, Dr. Elaine Ingham, Soil Food Web, who's mm-hmm. a person I've been working with since I met her. She is, you know, but primarily it's a lot of guys. There are a lot of women in the periphery.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the world of agronomy is not dominated by women. It's dominated by white males. And unfortunately...
But if you get them to this family farm, people actually doing things with foods, they're close to the earth. You can... cheesemakers... You know, all that sort of thing, you can start to find more women.
But that's not the film I'm making.
Okay. I thought, for some reason, I thought you were going there.
No, because we've got a much larger problem. The local food movement...
Okay, then that's just my misunderstanding.
No, then that's great. But the local food movement is alive and well. And it's happening in pockets all over the country, mm-hmm. all over the world. And I applaud it. You know, the local's more important than organic. Mm-hmm. I hear that a lot. And it really, I cringe when I hear that, because within the context of access, that is a meaningless statement. Because if you have access, local is more important than organic. If you don't have access, if you have limited access, you better hope. Well, let me tell you a story. I was at the Land Institute in Kansas. Wes Jackson has some incredible plant geneticists. They're trying to breed perennial grains so that, you know, we have a... Anyway, that's a long story that'll be in the movie. But so I'm in Kansas, and there's the Dillon's Market in Kansas, and I'm looking for food to eat. And I go to the Dillon's, and there's no food in this supermarket. There's a little bit of there's a little organic section, and so I find some organic grains. I find a little bit of produce, but
was it mostly prepared stuff?
It was just mostly the highly processed organic options.
Okay.
So you know, but still, you know, wasn't I wasn't gonna die? But
mm-hmm.
Anyway, I eat meat. I believe in eating meat. And so I got on Joe Robinson's eatwild.com, and I started looking for anybody producing anything of value in the area, and I found this bison producer. And so I was like, great, tomorrow, they're like 15 miles south, tomorrow I'm going to be driving out in that area trying to shoot some feedlots. Mm-hmm. And so I went and I grabbed some bison brats and some ground bison. I got back to my trailer. I pull an Airstream trailer around and I stay wherever I, you know, go. Mm-hmm. And I was so excited, and I pulled the brats out, and I looked at the label, and it said, could contain some beef, corn syrup solids, sodium nitrate, potassium nitrate. Yeah, and I just went, I'm going to write a letter to Joe Robinson, because that's a great site. That's an important thing, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of, like, I was driving up 80 to the foothills the other day, and somewhere in Dixon I saw local almonds, and it was like, no, I would rather eat store-bought organic almonds from anywhere than the local almonds that are grown in soil that is fumigated and then, you know, and planted and then sprayed mm-hmm. prophylactically. And so these things are good because they mean something, but I think we have to be clear about the context of how they're meant. And so until we fix the worst processed food on the shelves in our largest box stores and supermarkets, mm-hmm. we're still failing as a civilization.
Yeah. And do you see a way that we can actually, that one could actually affect that?
Part, one of the little themes in that little short is, and the little statement is that the cavalry is here, and we have all the intelligence, all the at least anecdotal research. The establishment research is contradictory, but as Alan Savory puts it, lots of independent research mm-hmm. has been proved.
So, do you see that part of the challenge is engaging people in an intellectual, you know, in sort of an intellectual awakening, stimulating an intellectual awakening in people, and that will be what changes their diet?
Well, I'm going to go emotionally first, because uh-huh. I think that if it stays intellectual, people aren't going to change behavior.
Uh-huh.
But absolutely, what needs to happen is we have a political system that really is not about and for the people. It's very influenced by corporate interests. And as Joel Salatin, I love this one. I love a lot of things that he says. But one of the things he says is it's not a conspiracy. It's a fraternity of ideas. And I love that, because it is this collusion that keeps things the way they are. There's a reason why we know that corn, commodity corn, is not a real good staple for our diet. High fructose corn sweetener, a lot of the, you know, mm-hmm. the ADM fodder, the Cargill, the bulk of what's produced agriculturally in our country is not really good for our health. It's not good for as feed for animals. It's
good for the planet.
Yeah, it's not good for the planet. It's a bad thing to do. We also know that it was in the National Geographic, that real leftist magazine. National Geographic did a whole big thing on biofuels, and it really showed corn ethanol. The best case scenario is it's about a 3% net gain energetically.
Mm-hmm.
And so and people don't know that corn's grown with fossil fuels, you know, with anhydrous ammonia, half of which goes is completely leaching, probably more, I bet, but mm-hmm. 25% of which actually ends up in the Gulf of Mexico. And we know these things. These things are common knowledge, and yet corn production went up 25% this year.
It did?
Yeah.
Went up 25%.
25%. Oh. In the same year that anhydrous ammonia went from $500 a ton to $800 a ton. So, and all of the infrastructure that's being put in to process corn into ethanol. So we're in this really interesting place where we're pushing the pendulum so far, but what most people don't know is that all that corn's GMO. Mm-hmm. That corn makes up all the, you know, big cereal brands that we get. Most of everything we eat, if it's processed and if you look at it and it has more than five ingredients, all of which that you recognize, you're eating GMO corn.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're the ones who are keeping that system in place by the way that we spend our dollars at the store. And as long as we do that, they're going to keep producing it because those companies are doing great.
But, you know, you can quit buying it.
Well, I have.
I can quit buying it.
Yeah.
Lawrence can quit buying it, and I'm sure we all have.
Yeah.
But people who have three or four kids, they both, mother and father, work. You know, they never have family meals together. They do big box shopping.
Yeah.
They don't think. They don't have time to sort of I think one of the problems is much of the generation that is raising kids right now was raised by parents who were also both working and family meals weren't a tradition. Sort of have a generation, most of whom were raised without the family meal and family cooking tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And so that probably scares me more than anything because you have less emotional strings to pull because they don't think, oh, yeah, you know, we used to have Sunday dinner with my grandmother and my grandfather, and I loved that, and I loved seeing my mom cook. We don't have that to the degree that we've had it in the past. So that's why I can never quite figure out how it's going to happen.
Well, I mean, it's going to happen because cheap food is why we're here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cheap food. Earl Butz, cheap food. Just did a little film festival, and Ian Chaney was there with King Korn. And he went and visited Earl Butz, who kind of made the corn thing happen. And
Tell us who Earl Butz is.
Earl Butz was the Secretary of Agriculture under, you know, I'm not a historian or
I think it was
Nixon administration or
was
just before. Maybe.
Or was it Johnson?
Johnson, could have been Johnson.
I think it was Johnson.
Could Chuck Walters call me and tell me about that? Anyway,
but
it was back. It was back then.
Secretary of Agriculture.
Back
that's
then
all we
when,
needed.
When people were, you know, kind of starting to really take advantage, Anyway, so an interesting fact right now is that, you know, we are of our nation spends the least amount of our disposable income on food.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time I was using 10%. Well, that's dropped down to 8% of our disposable income is spent on food. And I think the next closest, don't correct, you can call in and tell me I'm wrong, but, you know, the next closest is like 30% or something. Just like fuel, you
mm-hmm.
know. You know, everybody thinks that we're spending a lot on fuel, and, you know, the rest of the world spends $8, $10, $12 a gallon on gas. And we should, too. Anyway, the same time that figure has dropped down to 8%, are the amount of our disposable income that we spend on health care has increased to 16%. So
be nice to reverse those two figures.
Well, yeah, or, you know, it's nice that we know we've got that percentage to play with, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've got a total of 24%. I'd rather spend, you know, 1% or 0% on health care.
Yeah.
And 24%
on
my food. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, it looks like this, you know. So people have to understand that. I got a call to speak to the FFA this year. They have a big annual convention down in Indiana. And friends of mine, Trader's Point Creamery, they have an organic grass-based dairy,
mm-hmm.
And they make incredible yogurts.
Trader's Point, where are they located?
They're in Zionsville, Indiana.
Okay.
And they said, you know, we're going to have tours. Some of the kids can come and see an organic dairy, and we need to have a speaker, and we want you. And I was like, wow, cool. So I went and I spoke to the Future Farmers of America. You know, 15-year-old kids on the average,
mm-hmm.
And largely children of conventional farmers. What was the question? The point here is, great Mother Earth News did a great thing. Last time I was at Joel's at Polyface Farms, Joel gave me an issue of this Mother Earth News, and they did their own little kind of anecdotal study where they took the national average for eggs, nutritional data on the national average for eggs, and then they took U.S. Secretary Earl Butz was the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture from 71 to 76. Great. He resigned in 76 over a racist joke.
Yeah, I remember that joke. Bad guy.
Good guys. God, I love these guys. Huh? Anyway, the Mother Earth News did this great thing where they said, okay, let's take them at their words. So they sent 10 different pastured brands of eggs, Polyface being one of them. They sent them in and they had nutritional testing done. I guess they put it through a mass spec or something. So they came up with this incredible nutritional data that showed against the national average for conventional eggs. And the egg board says there's no difference between eggs grown here and eggs grown there. Basically, that's the argument. They always say that. And if they say it and it's published, it must be
people believe
true.
It.
Yeah, right. Anyway, the nutritional data is off the charts, 2 to 10 times the nutritional content. And so I like use this as an example to this group, and I said, so you could eat one of these eggs, or you could eat 5 of these eggs. I mean, you don't get more because you ate more. In fact, you weigh more, but you don't actually.
You get more calories, but not more nutrients.
Yeah, no, the nutrients are not there, and so you get empty calories, which. Not a big benefit. And one of the moms piped up and she said, but I still need 3 eggs for my cake. And she's right. But the point is that, you know, if that cake costs you $1.50 to make or $3 to make, if you could have some kind of nutritional basis in it, wouldn't you rather give your
use the better eggs?
Yeah,
the better eggs.
And don't you just want those eggs in your cupboard? So
now, are you going to make some? I mean, because when you say we are what we eat, I'm a very much a visual thinker, so I'm thinking if you picture chickens running around and getting to be chickens and having pecking orders, and you know, hunting and scratching and doing what they do versus chickens stacked on top of each other in 24-hour light, which would you rather be? You know, do you want your food coming from a happy chicken or from a miserable chicken? To me, that seems like no contest.
It's no contest. Here's another one, though. I was shooting processing, again, back to Joel Salatin's. It's a great place. I spent a lot of time. Anytime I was anywhere near there, I would drop in, and wonderful family, incredible people, and the apprentices that work there are my hope for the future. You know, these guys that are anywhere from 18 to 20, 25, just superlative human beings. You know, two primarily that I met in the process of being there, Matt Rails and Nathan Vergen. Just give me hope for our future. And there's a lot of really principled young people. So when they say, who's going to do this work? It's really educated, principled young people who are plentiful right now. I was shooting the processing and they were short a person. So I shut my camera off and I threw an apron on and I started, I jumped in to the line and helped process chickens. And I was eviscerating, and I was like, what's this, to Nathan? And he went, that's a gallbladder. And he took a knife, and he sliced it open, and he splayed it out, and in there was, like, little bits of white sandy gravel and the greenest green you can imagine. And what we're pretty certain is that a chicken that's raised on a purely grain diet has no chlorophyll in their diet. And chickens are supposed to have that chlorophyll. And so when you eat that chicken, which doesn't taste just like chicken, by the way, when you eat that chicken, it's an entirely different thing. And so you know, we've just moved so far from how these animals are supposed to happen. All of our health data is based on broken science. It's based on science that's been observing this.
Science on the service of corporate profit.
Well,
to
yeah,
some degree,
yeah. But also, we do have hard data on what happens when you eat beef that is produced the way beef isn't supposed to be produced. But that line is omitted,
right?
And so we have all this data on heart disease, but we don't know what it's like when you have beef that's grass finished, that has a healthy fatty acid profile, and has high CLAs, and all the things that beef is supposed to have, and then you eat it within context because that kind of beef is very dense and you don't need a 32-ounce steak to satisfy your hunger. And it's part of a diverse plate. So, you know, it's a big undertaking. There's so much information that we don't know. A lot of us are learning it, getting it, thanks to people like Michael Pollan. And there's a lot of messengers out there. But for the most part, my objective is how do we get that to the masses? How do we get that to the in the water, so to speak, so that we can't ignore that we're in the process of natural selection, we're choosing not to survive right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how do you see that coming about? Based on, you're talking about this group of really energetic young people who are sort of full of this passion. So do you see the foods that are available changing, or do you see the demand for foods changing what is available?
It's definitely going to be the demand changes what's available.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's why I'm a big proponent of organic. What, you know, the Soil Association is the probably the largest certification agency in England. But the Soil Association is its own brand. So here we have USDA Organic, and then we have different brands. Organic Valley is a large brand that has, I think, really good principles, good stakeholders to their producers. They're not a corporation. I mean, they're not a publicly traded financial corporation. They're a co-op. What the Soil Association did is they basically, you know, it was founded by Lady Eve Balfour. It was an agricultural charity, and what they've done with that brand is they've rendered the governmental standard a baseline standard, and they've elevated their. So basically, right now we've got the standard is part of the USDA, and the USDA is a questionable institution. You know, they just approved cloned animals, and they're not demanding labeling. And I really find that bizarre. We have plenty of studies that say our GBH, our BGH is bad for us.
And we should say that's the bovine growth hormone that, for example, clover, big dairy in the North Bay, they do not use milk that from cows that have been treated with that. So we're in a really lucky place, but that's what
RBGH, recombinant bovine growth hormone,
yes.
or bovine somatropin, RBST.
Go on.
I'm getting
you can get so distracted by flashing lights.
Ooh, what's the shiny thing? Where was I going? I know I was going somewhere.
Okay, well, you know what? We're going.
Are we going to take
straight out of time?
Oh, yeah.
Much more quickly than you're fascinating. I want to talk about the film specifically and what sort of timeline that film is on.
Well, the film was supposed to be completed now and at Sundance as we speak.
So maybe next year at Sundance?
Well, I think that's pushing it a little too far. The thing is that, and the way we're posturing ourselves in the world of fundraising, and the reason the fundraising didn't work is we were in a conversation with a big wheel production company, and it seemed like that was going to go really well, and then another film kind of scooped us there, and then we were kind of on the curb. But I'm not really making a film. I am creating a platform for information. And part of that platform is is a feature film because it's the mm-hmm. it's the easiest way to get a broad-based message
yeah,
out.
Yeah, to get reach a lot of people.
And, you know, films, you know, there's two different types of films. Films that have incredibly huge backing and massive casts and all that, and then indie films.
Oh, yes.
And the indie films, largely the world of theatrical distribution is kind of become a lost leader for mm-hmm. those types of films. Mm-hmm. Unless there's a real, you know, comet that takes off and has, you know, mm-hmm. makes you sure. know, 100 million at the box office. But what it does do is it gives you this tremendous amount of kind of free publicity.
Sure. And do you know Food First, that film that came out a couple years ago?
No.
So I want to put you, okay, well, we'll talk off
put
mic.
Me on the spot.
It's okay. I should have asked it in a different way so that I wouldn't.
We're at the end of our hour.
It's amazing we're running out of time.
Well, this was part one. We are what we eat, part one.
We are what we eat. So eat something. Somebody used to say, so eat something better looking, you know, smarter and better looking than you are.
Well, and we also have to say, I have to plug, we are what we eat. themovie.com.
Okay, that was my next question. So we are what we eat, themovie.com. Yeah. And let me spell your name. It's Aaron Lucich. It's A-A-R-O-N.
Yeah.
L-E-U-C-I-C-H.
L-U.
Oh, L-U.
C-I.
L-U-C-I.
C-H.
I got an E in there. And you have contact information on your website. People can just link to send you an email, right?
Yeah, you can link to contact. You can also go to my business website, which is inprocessmedia.com.
In process?
Yeah.
Inprocessmedia.com. So thank you for zipping on up here in the rain and bringing all these good things to eat, Aaron.
Yeah.
And when you get closer to having something that's ready, will you come back?
Oh, I'll come back whenever you want. This was fun.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Whenever an hour flies by as fast as it did, you know you're having a good time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
And I wish you luck in this endeavor. We need as many people as we can possibly get thinking like you're thinking.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You betcha.
Thanks, Lawrence.
I'll be right back. Is there anything you should do in your kitchen or pantry to mark the beginning of a new year or the approach of a new season? With the winter holidays finally behind us, it's a good idea to take stock of the situation in the kitchen. Tonight, the Good Cook's Pantry offers some suggestions. Are there moths in your flour? Holes in your potholders? Stains on all your tea towels? Have the tips of your rubber spatulas melted after stirring one too many sauces? Are your knives too dull to slice butter? What about those spices? Are they older than your grown children? Cooking, no matter how good your ingredients, can be frustrating when the basics and the right tools are not at hand and the kitchen is in disarray. So, here's what I suggest. Buy a half dozen white cotton tea towels and keep them in a convenient drawer to use whenever a recipe calls for them. These are not hand towels, but towels that will come into direct contact with food. Keep them clean and close at hand. While you're at it, get at least two heavy-duty potholders. Take your kitchen knives to the cutlery store where you bought them or to the knife sharpener at your local farmer's market. If you don't have a good knife, buy one with a forged blade and a handle that fits your hand comfortably. Several colorful rubber spatulas from Le Creuset are essential to any good cook's kitchen. They have a higher temperature tolerance than the common white ones. Those are the ones that melt and are useful for everything from getting that last bit of mustard out of a small jar to stirring risotto and scraping sauces and such into saucepans into serving bowls. If your wooden spoons are spindly, broken, or burned, and lots of mine are just that, invest in a few new ones, selecting those with sturdy handles, which last longer. Stand them in a container near the stove so that you don't have to hunt for them while you are cooking. Put flowers and grains with moths into the compost and store newly purchased ones in individual glass jars. Moths are inevitable. Even if you get them out of your own pantry, you'll bring more in from the market. And so buy in smaller rather than larger quantities. Get amounts that you'll use in a couple of months. The glass jars won't solve the problem, but they will contain it and slow it down just a bit. Toss out all the spices you have not used in the last year. When you replenish your supply, buy in quantities that you'll use within a few months and mark each bottle or tin with the date of purchase. If you tend to these things now, by the time the year of the rat begins on February 7th, you'll be ready for all that will soon unfold in our fields and on our farms. Spring is not that far away. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan with the Good Cook's Pantry on Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. Talk to you next week.
A Short History of the American Stomach by Frederick Kaufman is a bilious little book that will ruin your appetite. That's not to say there's nothing to be gained by perusing this vituperative little volume. Just don't do it on a full stomach. Kaufman, a professor of English at City University of New York, looks at America's four-century obsession with food and decides that the stomach is the perfect metaphor for American society. The stomach, after all, is the great consumer. And what better symbol for a country that from its very start was hell-bent on devouring everything in its path? Land, trees, animal, indigenous cultures, and of course, food, glorious food in copious quantities. Kaufman shows that the supersize me ethic is nothing new. This kind of orgiastic indulgence in culinary plenty has been with us almost from the beginning. Washington Irving was one of the first writers to take note of it, commenting that, quote, gourmandizing prevails through every class of society. Not a soul but has caught this infection. But in America, where food is concerned, excess always travels with its ascetic twin, self-denial. The Puritans were masters of this, and Kaufman devotes a whole chapter to the gruesome gustatory advice of Cotton Mather. Regular fasting was all the rage in Puritan New England, where it was actually mandated by law. It's not surprising to learn, then, that Mather was the first settler to describe what we understand as anorexia nervosa in preteen girls. Mather, who considered becoming a physician before taking to the pulpit, also prescribed vomiting as a cure for a long list of woes from asthma to vertigo. He was also an advocate of drinking your own urine, or that of healthy young men, mixed with sugar and wine. Yum! A Short History of the American Stomach leaps back and forth from century to century, detailing our twin obsession with binging and purging. He chooses some easy targets: the Food Network, diet doctors, competitive eaters, as well as our weird obsession with gigantic food, the world's largest taco, the world's largest round of cheese. I really could have done without the puerile Food Network chapter, where he enlists the aid of a pornographic photographer to help him understand the technical underpinnings of what is now popularly called gastroporn. No Freudian was ever more intent on seeing sex everywhere she looked. But honestly, sometimes a wooden spoon is just a wooden spoon. Other chapters poke fun at New York City's raw milk underground, GMO oysters, or the intricacies of keeping kosher in an age of biotechnology. Yes, they really do have rabbis blessing petri dishes. There's much fun to be had here and some fascinating history to be learned, though Kaufman's snarky, superior tone did begin to grate on me after a while. But here's the good news. After digesting 194 pages on gobbling, guzzling, gulping, and regurgitating, I couldn't eat for the rest of the day. I think I lost 2 pounds. This is Laura Hager for Mouthful.
It's time for dinner now, let's go.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthfuls@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.
Every woman, a child and man, I sang to the Lord that praises me. It's time for dinner now, let's go eat. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher said. To the Lord, let praise.
stop preaching and a hush the church did fill. And then a
support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the 286 horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.